From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We have an idealized vision of dying, serene, surrounded by family and peace. And then there's the frequent American reality, a beloved elder dying in a hospital amid interventions and tubes and beepers. And the question, was it kind of cruel? A new report out last week says it's time for a big overhaul of the way we die and care for the dying. This hour on Point, dying in America and the call for a kinder, gentler way to go. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Did you spend your parents' final months with them in a hospital? Was it hard on them, hard on you? Do you see a better way? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll talk with Ezekiel Emanuel, Rahm Emanuel's brother, who writes recently that he wants to go at 75. That gets political. But first, joining me now from Fairfield, Connecticut, is David Walker, former Comptroller General of the United States under Presidents Clinton and Bush II. He was co-chair of the Institute of Medicine's big nonpartisan committee on aging that just published a 507-page report called Dying in America. David Walker, welcome to On Point.
Tom, it's good to be with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
You've got a big group here. Illustrious doctors, nurses, insurers, religious leaders, lawyers, and experts on aging putting a lot of effort into looking at this issue of dying in America, coming out with a great big report. What makes dying the way we die worth all this attention and time and focus, David?
Well, we had 21 individuals with varied backgrounds who dedicated over 2 years on a part-time basis to come up with the report results. And it started, quite frankly, Tom, because of a lot of the controversy associated with the Affordable Care Act and a lot of the sensationalism that was surrounding that. But after doing this work, we found that our current healthcare system is poorly designed to meet the needs of patients near the end of life, and that it needs major changes in order to provide quality healthcare that is compassionate, that is affordable and sustainable over time.
In practical terms that people would recognize, what do you mean by that, the problem with the current system?
All too frequently, individuals' preferences are not honored, in some cases because they're not understood, in some cases because they're not adequately documented, in some cases because they're not adequately accessible, if you will. Mm-hmm. And as a result, what ends up happening is that many times there are a variety of procedures that are performed that may or may not be consistent with the patient's desires. And our current system has a number of perverse incentives. It generally encourages practitioners to do more and more and more. It has preferences for in-hospital services and acute care services rather than services in other venues and more in appropriate circumstances, palliative care services. And so we looked at it from the standpoint of cure, comfort, and consolation. Those are the three things that have to be focused on, and we can come back from three dimensions. What do individuals need to do? What do clinicians need to do? And what changes are necessary by policymakers and payment systems?
We'll look at all three of those, but just to be sure we understand your perspective, what you're looking at on, give us a couple of if you could describe a couple of scenarios to you, to the panel, what's a kind of best case scenario? What's a worst case that you see manifest in our current system?
Well, a best case would be when an individual has engaged in appropriate consideration of end-of-life issues with their family and with their loved ones. They have documented what their desires are. They are periodically reviewed and updated based upon changes in circumstances. They are captured in electronic records. They are effectively communicated. That individual has a designated person who is their agent in the event that they're not in a position to represent themselves because, as you know, Tom, there can be differences between the opinions of family and loved ones. Mm-hmm. They're able to potentially be in their home to provide appropriate services, including palliative care services, and they pass peacefully with their loved ones and others in a manner that is consistent with their wishes. Another case might be where either their desires are not ever determined, they're not ever documented, they're not properly accessed. They end up having challenges, and even though they might prefer to be in their home, they're not allowed to because of the current reimbursement systems, including under Medicare. And so as a result, when they have a problem, they'll call their physician, primary care. If they're not on service, they say call 911. You call 911, an ambulance comes out. That's very expensive. It takes you to a hospital. You end up going into in the emergency room, mm-hmm. ultimately potentially to intensive care. There's a bunch of different procedures that are performed, which may or may not be consistent with your desires. That's an example, and we can come up with many over mm-hmm. time. The real key here is our focus was on individual choice, quality, and compassion. And if you focus on those three things, you can end up making changes to the system that will accomplish those objectives as well as reduce cost and hopefully stabilize total health care and social service costs over time as compared to our current fragmented system.
May I ask you, why does it happen that people end up in the hospital having all kinds of treatment that they may not want? Are hospitals required to perform every intervention that might imaginably be thrown at a problem, or is it a business case that's driving those decisions?
Well, as you know, physicians are trained to try to be able to help people and try to be able to save lives. And their training is basically focused on curative training. In addition to that, if you look at our current payment systems, they are largely fee-for-service. People are encouraged to do more. In addition, the payment systems are not necessarily properly considering the desires of the individual. They're not necessarily evidence-based. And so as a result, you take the current systems, you take family members and loved ones who would like to have as much done as possible to help save dad or mom or brother or sister or whomever it might be. And those things all combine to create a system where more is done, invasive, inpatient, which may or may not be consistent with the patient's desires, which may or may not be evidence-based. That's where we are today, a very fragmented system that clearly is unsustainable in its present form.
So let's begin to walk through how this big report, 500-plus pages, suggests we change this situation. Dive in where you will. How would you begin to make a change toward what exactly?
Well, let's talk about three dimensions, and then we can talk mm-hmm. about each one. We basically said that there need to be major changes to our current healthcare system in order to improve quality, honor individual choice, enhance compassion, and the byproduct, we believe, will be reduced cost and stabilization of cost, both healthcare and social services, over time as compared to the status quo. Three dimensions. One, what individuals can and should do to take control of the quality of their life and the healthcare that they achieve, both throughout their lives and at the end of life. Secondly, okay. mm-hmm. What needs to be done to enhance the capacity and the quality of services being provided by clinicians? And then last, what changes are necessary with regard to policymakers and payment systems to make sure that we're paying for the right things at the right time in the right place and not providing perverse incentives? For individuals, we recommend a life cycle approach. All too frequently, what we see now is a focus on a one-time event of documenting an advanced directive with checkboxes all too late in life.
Maybe, a kind of living will. That's one
form. Mm-hmm. But basically what we're recommending is that we need to have a life cycle approach. People need to think about these issues earlier in life based upon major milestones in life, for example, when they reach adulthood. when they get married, when they have children, when they're eligible for Medicare.
You're saying even even teens, when they get their driver's license, they might give a first thought to how they want things at the
Well,
end.
We encourage them to do so. That doesn't mean that they will do so, okay? And I think you and I know both know, Tom.
Very unlikely. They're immortal.
Yeah, very unlikely. That's right. One can be encouraged, but that doesn't mean you're required to.
Yep.
On the other hand, when you reach certain ages, for example, when you're eligible for Medicare, you know that's obviously a more important age. When you contract a serious illness or you have a catastrophic accident and therefore, you know, end-of-life considerations may be before you, there are certain times where clearly it makes sense. But we're encouraging people to do it earlier when they're not in the final phase of life, if you will. We also are encouraging people to have conversations with their primary care physicians, also with their family members and other loved ones. We're encouraging them to also have a designated agent who can represent them in the event that they're not in a position to be able to represent themselves, and to try to be able to, you know, cut through the differences of opinions that all too frequently exist between family members and others.
What portion of Americans do you think are adequately sort of positioned toward these questions now, today? Half, a third, 90%?
Less than half. I don't have a specific percentage to give you, but clearly less than half are today. And as I said, the advanced directives are one thing, living wills are one thing. One of the new innovations is something called POST, is a physician's order that, frankly, has a lot more meaningful information in it than typically what you would see in an advanced directive, and that's something that needs to be considered.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how we die and maybe when. My guest is David Walker, co-chair of the Institute of Medicine's Nonpartisan Committee on Aging. They just published a 507-page report called Dying in America. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. He is former Comptroller General of the United States under Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. We're going to hear later in this hour from Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel. That's Rahm Emanuel's brother. He's big in medical ethics, had a significant role in the Affordable Care Act, who's written recently that he hopes to go at 75, and after that, no major interventions, please. That gets political, but we'll talk to him in a few minutes. Dr. Walker is with us from Fairfield, Connecticut. David Walker, we looked at individuals here. You also talked about clinicians and therapies, and you talked about the system overall, the changes that this big panel is recommending. Take us in.
Well, let's talk about clinicians. Basically, we have a number of recommendations designed to enhance the capacity and improve the training and capability of clinicians to be able to provide a quality consultation with their patients in a way that will result in honoring patients' values and informed preferences much more than it does today.
You're right that they're not being trained to do that much at all at this
point.
Not enough.
Absolutely. With regard to the medical schools, there are also not enough people who are palliative care specialists. But frankly, given the demographic tidal wave that we are now entering right now with the aging of the baby boom generation, the retirement of that generation, the fact is you're not going to be able to have enough palliative specialists. And so therefore, general practitioners and other clinicians need to be trained with regard to palliative care in order to enhance capacity. Credentialing organizations, accrediting organizations, certifying bodies need to also play a role here in order to make sure that we don't just have an adequate number of people, but they're adequately trained. These are difficult conversations to have, Tom. I mean, individuals don't want to talk about end of life. It's difficult for physicians to do it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, they're not trained to do it. The Hippocratic Oath is such that their job is to cure, and that's appropriate in a vast majority of circumstances. But there are times when that's not appropriate, and when patients have said it's not appropriate, and their preferences need to be honored.
I'm reading here one of your committee members, Diane Meyer, saying that this would require a revolution in healthcare education. That sounds like a big overhaul.
Well, it's clearly transformative. There's no question about that. And More needs to be done with regard to medical schools, but it's not just with regard to physicians. I mean, you know, we have, you know, nurses and other practitioners that need to be engaged in this as well, because, you know, you're not going to be having enough physicians or palliative care specialists to get the job done given known demographic trends.
Go to the system level. I mean, we live in systems and they govern a lot of payment, and payment governs a lot more. What are you proposing there?
We have a very fragmented system. We separate health care from social services. We have a system that is fragmented with regard to providers. We have a system that is fragmented with regard to where services can be performed in order to be reimbursed. Let's talk about some examples of current systems and payment policies. At the present point in time, Medicare will not reimburse physicians for having advanced care discussions with their patients. One of the recommendations that we have is that needs to change. They need to be adequately trained. They need to have time to do it. And in order to maximize the chance that they actually will do it, they need to be reimbursed. We have circumstances now where in order to be eligible for hospice care, it's very important, palliative care is different than hospice. Palliative care doesn't just apply in hospice. It's a portion of hospice, but it's not the only thing. We have a circumstance where Medicare says you can't be referred to hospice until you're within 6 months of expecting to pass. And the data says that the typical tenure in hospice is about 18 days. So people are getting referred very late to hospice. We have circumstances in which, in order for providers to get paid, the services have to be performed in the hospital. And therefore, if the patient doesn't have somebody to take them to the hospital, that means you're going to have an ambulance. That means you're going into the ER, et cetera. And we also have circumstances where services that patients would prefer, individuals prefer to have the services performed at home, can't be performed at home. Last, another example is we don't have a point person. And I'm not talking about necessarily a physician, but a point person who knows the individual, who knows what their challenges are, who knows who their different providers are, who individuals can call in an emergency or other situation to take the pressure off of 9/11 calls and emergency room visits, et cetera.
I want to begin to bring our listeners in. David Walker is with us, co-chair of the Institute of Medicine's big 507-page report. This was put together by doctors, nurses, insurers, religious leaders, lawyers, experts on aging. He is former Comptroller General of the United States under Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. Of course, this whole issue has been political as well, but it's also very personal. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, Julie is calling. Hi, Julie. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had to actually move in with my dad and my granddad for a couple of months to take care of them. It was really difficult. They both wanted to die at home. We found out both of them were terminal basically on the same day. And it's really hard because you've got to fight family, too, who wants to keep them in the hospital or put them into hospice somewhere else outside of the house. And had we not had the money to bring attorneys into the house to get all the medical stuff taken care of and the healthcare proxies and stuff, which, of course, they hadn't done, and to bring someone in to help who knew what they were doing, because I certainly did not, it would have been impossible, and it just has to be easier.
Why was anybody resisting the hospice, Julie? What was the thinking or the emotion?
Well, they would have preferred them in hospice.
Oh, I see.
The house. Well,
and so why did they prefer hospice? I'm just curious.
I think it's just easier and neater and cleaner. It's very hard to sit at home and, watch parents die.
Yeah. And did it work out all right in the end? You spent 2 months on it.
My grandfather ended up dying in the hospital. My father did end up dying at home, and it was as peaceful as I guess that it could be. But within the family, it set up a 5-year fight afterwards about the way the money was spent keeping him at home.
Yeah. Julie, I hope that has healed or is healing, and I appreciate your call. If I may, let me get another. Old Lyme, Connecticut. Deirdre is calling. Deirdre, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm okay.
I'm calling. I just lost my dad last week.
Sorry.
And he died at home. I've been a nurse for over 30 years, a hospital-based nurse, and so I see what happens in the hospital. And, you know, and my parents, both, my mom's still living, both preferred to die with hospice.
What do you see happening in the hospital, Deirdre? You've done it for 30 years as a nurse. What is it that you see what happens there?
Oh, it's just, it's not home. I mean, it's not humane. It's like your guest was saying, we are trained to do everything we can possibly do to keep someone alive.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets to the point of almost the absurd.
But don't people in the hospital know that at some point? I mean, can't you look at each other and, you know, kind of just with a facial gesture,
sure,
say, aren't we finished here?
You can, but you can't. I mean, there's such a liability there. If someone does not have a living will or an advance directive, if mm-hmm. they do not have a do not resuscitate order, mm-hmm. you are legally bound.
So what was your personal experience, Deirdre? What was your personal experience with your father who passed so recently?
Well, we had the advance directives. I'm his advocate. We had everything in place. We brought him home. We had, am I allowed to say the hospice company?
There's no need, but...
Okay, well, we had a national hospice company that's supposed to be great.
Mm-hmm.
We got him home. This was wonderful. My mom and I were there. We had such issues. I'm going to be better prepared for my mom.
Like what?
Well, the nursing staff wasn't there. We didn't have the morphine that he needed. He was in an incredible amount of pain.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have the medication that we needed at first. He was in pain. Then we didn't have staffing. They wouldn't even call and say, oh, we don't have staffing. Someone would show up from an agency and say, oh, well, Vita's the, oh, whoops, they don't have the staffing.
Mm-hmm.
Or someone just wouldn't show up at all. And it would just be my mom and I there going, okay, what do we do next? Fortunately,
gosh,
I have the training and I could administer the
morphine.
You're
a nurse, yeah.
But then, you know, also when I could see that the morphine needed to be increased, I can't do that. I need a doctor's order. And there was no doctor to be found with this company. It was, so I think that my dad, it was wonderful that my mom and I were there, with the three of us were together.
Yeah.
And, you know, we could tell him that we loved him and say everything that we wanted to say and be with him. But the hospice experience, my dad lingered for 10 days in horrible pain.
Deirdre, I appreciate your call, and you're a nurse, and I'm sorry for that pain. I'm glad you were with your dad, you and your mom, and I appreciate your sharing that. David Walker, does your report bring solutions to that kind of situation? After all, here's a death that was outside the hospital. It was a hospice care situation, at least staffing-wise. It seems to be what you're promoting, and yet you hear Deirdre, who's a trained nurse, how difficult it was.
Well, it wasn't clear to me from Deirdre's standpoint that it was whether or not it was in a hospice facility.
Not
or
in, but a hospice company
hospice
helping them at home.
If you will. Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, first, let's say that both Julie and Deirdre obviously should be commended for the fact that they took on the burden to be able to honor their family's wishes. And it is a huge burden. There's no question about that. So on one hand, at least in the case of Deirdre's side, her father had expressed his preferences with regard to what he wanted. He had designated her. It sounds to me that the real challenge there was execution by the provider, that the provider did not provide the kind of services in a timely manner that were necessary. And clearly, to the extent that we're going to allow for more of this to be done at home, especially mm-hmm. if it's publicly reimbursed, then that's an area that has to be focused on. Frankly, the federal government does a lot better job of trying to ensure equity and trying to ensure performance than they are in, you know, trying to help manage cost and other types of things.
To get your proposals into effect, what does it take? A directive, legislation? I mean, we had a huge healthcare overhaul just a few years ago. It was very controversial, very difficult to get through. Do we need to go through that again? And the death part of it, death panels, they became labeled by Affordable Care Act critics, was one of the most controversial elements of it. What would it take to move the country toward a system more like what you're recommending?
Tom, I think it's important to note that a vast majority of our recommendations will not take legislation. The recommendations that we talk about with regard to individuals, the recommendations that we talk about with regard to the training and credentialing of clinicians, those generally do not require legislation. Some of the ones that we recommend with regard to payment systems and policies, CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, might have the ability to do some. They may be somewhat reticent to do it in light of the controversy associated with the Affordable Care Act. You know, an example of what would require legislation is to be able to reimburse physicians for advanced care planning discussions. That mm-hmm. clearly would. Being able to take a look at the rules surrounding hospice, when you can be referred to hospice, what type of services should be reimbursable in hospice and not, whether or not you can have certain services provided at your home rather than having to go into an inpatient facility. Those are things that may well require legislation. But it's something that we need to take a hard look at, and we recommend that to the extent that legislation is necessary, that it be enacted. You know, our current system is clearly not providing the type of quality care, you know, with the type of compassion that is necessary, honoring individual choice. And, Tom, very important point. Mm. Death panels were all about the government allegedly deciding what was going to be done to whom and when. That's not what we dealt with. What we dealt with is that we are honoring individual choice. And our view is very strongly that if you honor individual choice, if you end up implementing these recommendations, you will have better care, more compassion, and over time, less cost than otherwise would be the case. And as evidence of that, there are private insurers, including Aetna, that are adopting a number of these recommendations, I'm sure in the interest of their insured, but also because they believe that from a financial standpoint, it's likely to be better as well.
You were Comptroller General of the United States, a kind of a big auditor for the whole country's finances. How important might those cost savings be to the nation's budget over the coming decades?
Well, let's make it very clear. This report was about quality, compassion, and choice, and cost was a afterthought. In other words, it's a byproduct of adopting this. But there's absolutely no question that we've got to do something to be able to deal with our huge unfunded health care promises. We promised more than we've got the resources to deliver. Health care costs continue to grow faster than the economy. We face known demographic trends that are going to exacerbate that over time. But it was choice and quality first, and cost reductions or stabilization was a byproduct of our work, and that's worth pursuing.
But the question again, how big a deal is some change on that front to the nation's budget?
It's a huge deal. The number one challenge that we face from a fiscal standpoint is health care cost. It's the number one fiscal challenge for the United States of America. It's the number one fiscal challenge for certain other levels of government. And it's a major challenge with regard to, you know, employers as well. It's also, you know, one of the major reasons why wages have been stagnant for a long time, because we're spending more and more on health care.
You've been in the thick of it as Comptroller General. How much of that challenge would be addressed by changing the way we die? Is it a significant shift?
Well, I think it's important that this would clearly help, but a lot of the principles that we have in here, frankly, apply beyond just end of life, although our charge was the final phase of life. People that had advanced serious illness, and it was expected that they were going to pass in the not too distant future. You know, this is a positive step, but clearly more work needs to be done that was beyond the scope of this report, dealing with what level of universal health care should be provided, who should be subsidized and when, how people should be paid. There's a variety of other issues that need to be looked at, went far beyond the scope of this report.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how we die and maybe when. David Walker has been with us. He's co-chair of the Institute of Medicine's Nonpartisan Committee on Aging. They just published a big 500-plus page report on dying in America. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. With us as well right now from Philadelphia is Dr. Zeke Emanuel, brother of Rahm Emanuel, chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania, former special advisor to the White House on health policy in the Obama administration, former chair of the Department of Bioethics at the National Institutes of Health until August of 2011. He also served on President Clinton's health care task force. had a piece that just came out in The Atlantic, the headline, Why I Hope to Die at 75. And the piece, the essay begins, 75, that's how long I want to live, 75 years. Zeke Emanuel, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Why 75? Why not 85, 95, 65?
Well, first of all, 75 is a point in time, but what I go over in the essay, and by the way, I didn't pick the title. It's not my title. What I go over in the essay is to look at what is a good life and to get us to shift away from thinking about just how long we live to thinking about the quality of our life. And I look at things like disability and the fact that over the last 25 years, as we add more years to life, we also add more disability. We're not actually reducing the morbidity, as the experts call it. Similarly, I look at Alzheimer's disease and the increase in Alzheimer's disease, the fact that by 85, between one-third and one-half of people have Alzheimer's disease. And then I also look at issues like creativity and the decline of people's creativity, the slowing down of the mind, and how you want to be remembered by your children, your community, what you want to contribute. And it seems to me that when you take all those factors in, for me personally, it's 75. And by the way, as I make very clear in the essay, it's not that I'm going to kill myself. It's not that I want euthanasia. I've been against legalizing euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide for decades. It's that I'm just going to stop going to the doctor and stop taking medications and things where the purpose of them is to make me live longer. I will still take medications that relieve severe symptoms like pain or shortness of breath. So it's a kind of subtle notion that isn't like I'm 75, I'm walking onto an iceberg. That's not the philosophy.
I think you are, if I'm correct, Zeke Emanuel, I think you're 57 today as we speak.
Correct. 18 more years.
75 is a ways off. I know plenty of 75-plus people who still enjoy life quite a lot. Do you think you're going to stick with this when you're 75?
That is the first response whenever you talk to almost anyone, no matter what their age is. They begin pointing out the 1, 2, 3 people, maybe the 10 people they know who are 75 and doing well. So let me make just a couple of points there.
I mean, on that front, you know, my great aunt, Ciara, was 102 when she dangled me on her lap when I was a tiny boy. She was 10 years old in the Civil War. I look back on those photographs with some exquisite pleasure to think about that link across a great expanse of time. And there she was, you know, I was a babe and she was dandling me, and that was kind of nice.
Yeah, and that's terrific if that can happen. And I'm not against that happening, and I know that for some people that's living as long as possible is really important. And I want, again, part of the issue here is to make people focus on what is important to them, what elements of life are important. And this is a statistical thing. There are certainly some people who will escape physical disability, will be perfectly clear in their mind, will be productive and creative out to 100. That's an outlier, and by definition, it's rare. And by, you know, you picking up one, your great aunt, doesn't mean that's how most of us, the vast majority of us, are going to end up. And so finding an anecdote is not doesn't defeat my argument.
Oh, secondly, it's not an anecdote. It's my great aunt. It's family.
Exactly. And I think that's, again, for her, it may have been exactly right. For me, right, if I'm remembered by my children or my grandchildren as shuffling around or not being quite mentally there, that would be, in my view, a terrible tragedy. I don't want them to remember me in that way. And by the way, as people decline and lose their memory or get Alzheimer's or their physical disability, as one of your callers suggested, it begins to dominate. It begins to crowd out other positive memories and other positive experiences. And I think a big – I mean, that's one thing I'm very – worried about.
Your mom and dad, if I have it right, your folks, Rahm's folks, are in their late 80s. What do they think about your perspective?
Well, I quote my father in the piece, if you read it, and he says that, yes, my life has slowed down. I can't teach. I don't make rounds anymore. But he
doesn't sound unhappy. He doesn't say, oh, yeah, let me go. Get me out of here.
Right. We had a very long discussion about it, and he is happy. And what gives him happiness is needling his children on the phone and talking to his grandchildren. And so if that's fine for him, he recognizes his life has been much limited by his condition. That's great. That's not my view. And remember, America is a country born on and believes in self-reliance, individualism. And I think my philosophy is kind of the old age of that American individualism and self-reliance, that democratic vision we have. And I'm trying, again, you keep pointing out, Tom, here's a family member, here's another family member. Mm-hmm. And I'm perfectly fine if that's the way they want to live. I love my father, and we had a very long discussion where, you know, we nicely disagreed about each of our views of life. And, you know, I'm perfectly content with that. And, you know, I help my father with his health issues whenever I can. And that I understand that.
But
I'm also asking people
I'm
asking people to think about the quality of the life they want, not just I want to live as long as possible, because I think that turns out to be a mirage and a fantasy.
You have a long history in public life, public policy. You write in the essay about something that you say Americans are kind of obsessed with, what you call the American immortal, the idea that we don't die or that we stay vigorous right to the end, which you point out does not happen nearly as much as people imagine. And you say, I think this manic desperation to endlessly extend life is misguided and potentially destructive for many reasons. 75 is a pretty good age to aim to stop. Is that purely personal, or is there a public exhortation or even policy piece in there as well?
Well, as I say in the piece, this isn't about rationing. As people say, we're spending more than enough money in the American healthcare system. I constantly emphasize we don't need to ration. We need, as David Walker says, to be more judicious and wise in how we're spending our money. It's not about the money. So the two policy recommendations that come out of my view is, first, we should not assess the quality of the American healthcare system by looking at life expectancy. And is our life expectancy equal to the Japanese, which is over 80? That seems to me not something we should concentrate on. If we want to evaluate the quality of the American healthcare system, we should look at items like, you know, premature births. We should look at infant mortality. We should look at adolescent mortality. All three of those, America's not doing very well, and I think we should concentrate on the children in that regard. We all believe, you know, our children are our most valuable resource. Well, I think we should try to prove it. And the second thing I say in this is, since disability and Alzheimer's are, I think, the primary things people are afraid of and really are horrified that might afflict them, I think putting them at the top of our research priorities is something that my view advocates. But it doesn't have anything to do with how we're going to allocate care at the end of life. I do think, and I've been working in the end-of-life care field for 30 years, since the mid-1980s, and was one of the original physicians working on how to improve care at the end of life. Having those discussions is critical. In the late 1980s, I developed an advanced care directive called the Medical Directive to try to promote this. We've spent a lot of time looking at this, and I recently wrote that, you know, having doctors and nurses trained in how to talk about end-of-life care, having people have access to palliative care both in the hospital and out of the hospital is something that ought to be a requirement for getting paid from Medicare. And I think those are important advances that we can do to improve the care of people, whatever their wishes are. But that's not what this essay is about. This essay is written personally. It's not a policy essay, as I say in it over and over again.
David Walker, interested in your perspective here. Let's start with life expectancy as a measure of our success in terms of health and health care. It's been a pretty good measure for a long time. I mean, the humanity was very happy as it moved up from 35 to 40 to 60 to now 75, and in some countries 80. Is it overrated, really?
Well, I think Zeke makes some very important points, and let me note at the outset that I've got a father who's 86 and a mother who's 85 years old. And I think several of the points that I would reinforce that are consistent with our report, he's focusing on quality of life rather than length of life. Now, personally, I believe that picking an age somewhat arbitrarily is not the way to do it. I think what you need to do is you need to look at facts and circumstances. What's the functionality of the individual? To what extent can the individual act independently and on their own? That may vary. It could be an earlier age for some people, a much later age for others, as it was for your great aunt. But I think the other thing that he's reinforcing, which is very important, is individual choice. And that's what our report focuses on. It's about individual choice, helping to make sure that individuals have the ability to make some of their own choices, and making sure that they have a quality life, not just a long life, hopefully both. But there is a trade-off.
What kind of medical directive do you need to go as far as Dr. Emanuel would go? That is, you know, keep me out of pain, but don't treat significant conditions after I'm 75. Is that possible, David Walker? Can you make a document that's so ironclad that major conditions that would be treatable can be ignored by the medical profession?
Well, we're seeing evolution with regard to advanced directives. I mean, one of the most recent ones is something called a PULSE, which is Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. And I think as time goes on, we'll end up, you know, seeing an evolution of that. I mean, Zeke is really going further than what most of the ones do right now. He's basically saying that as of a certain age, which, again, I don't condone. I think it should be facts and circumstances based upon your functionality and your degree of independence, that there are certain things that he will do and there are certain things he won't. No matter what a physician offers you, you don't have to do it. You're not required to do it. It's in circumstances where they're doing things on their own volition that I think a lot of these orders are focused on.
Let's go to John.
Tom, a lot of the advanced directives that have been developed, and again, beginning with ours in 1988-89, have gotten more specific. They have specified, you know, if I'm in a persistent vegetative state, don't do these treatments, whether it's dialysis or a respirator or blood transfusion or antibiotics. And you can specify the sort of common cases. There are a lot of common cases. And I think that kind of specificity helps rather, you know, it's hard for a doctor. I'm a physician, and it's hard for a doctor if a patient says, don't keep me alive unless I have some chance. Well, what's some chance mean in your mind? And is not keeping you alive or don't use heroic measures? Well, what's a heroic measure? Does that include things like dialysis, antibiotics, surgery, or not? So I think actually when families have a conversation, it is often helpful to be more specific rather than more vague and to be concrete. One of the things families find it useful for is to try to picture what those circumstances are and not just, you know, like Terry Schiavo. Well, what is it about Terry Schiavo that made you upset? And Terry Schiavo is a very good case where it wasn't really high tech that was keeping her alive. It was pretty basic stuff like artificial feeding and nutrition. And those have to be part of the discussion.
Let me ask both of you. We've got plenty of commenters online saying, yes, I want this freedom to choose. I want to be ready. I want to think it through. I don't want to be all beepered up. But here, Sam writes, it really feels like the powers up top are sick of paying entitlements to our seniors and want them to die off as early as possible because of population growth. After all, that is the biggest influence on the explosion in the population. He says, no, enough of this. It's time to die. It's time to go to heaven, BS. Dr. Manuel?
Well, first of all, my motivation has nothing to do with the money, as I make very clear in the article. And my motivation when I started in this area about trying to improve end-of-life care in the 1980s was really about the quality of life and the quality of the dying of the patients who I took care of. I went into oncology because I wanted to help people at a crisis in their life, whether just when they got diagnosed, and if we cured them, that was fantastic. And I also wanted to help them through the crisis that happens when they know they're going to die and to be able to have the comfort and to have the conversations with their family and to be around their family. It's not about the money. And I really, again, my piece is not at all about money. It is about living a life the way you want to. What's meaningful for you, and how does the system, including the healthcare system, allow that to happen? And that's our focus. I think putting our focus on money as if somehow a bunch of bean counters or accountants think that we are going to reduce costs, I don't think that's at issue here. We need better quality at a very critical moment in life. And I think one of its most critical aspects is, again, the memories you leave everyone in your family. If you're there suffering in bed, as one of your callers suggested, mm-hmm. in pain, that's a terrible memory for someone to live with. That's not the way you want them to live with their family. You want them to remember their family member as vigorous, as, you know, funny, as a happy, joyful person. And so part of my commitment to the end-of-life care field over 30 years has been to try to make that much more real, make those good moments the key element in a passing of life, which, after all, is inevitable for all of us.
Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. He writes in The Atlantic, headline, Why I Hope to Die at 75. What he says is, 75, that's how long I want to live, 75 years. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Dr. Emanuel, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And David Walker, co-chair of the Institute of Medicine's Nonpartisan Committee on Aging, and their big 500-plus page report, Dying in America. You can link to that at the website as well. Former Comptroller General of the United States, David Walker, thank you for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.